welcome to All Crime, No Cattle, a Texas True Crime podcast. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay.
And thank you for listening to our first podcast of 2018. This is episode 4, The Benefits of Kindness.
It's the murder and robbery of Bob Banks and Bob Skeens.
So you might be a little confused here. We did lie to you.
I committed perjury to you, the listeners, and for that I apologize. I'm sorry. You can give me all your hate in the comments and feedback or write me a crappy email.
So basically what happened was at the end of the last episode, we said we were going to be doing a serial killer this episode. And when Shay actually started doing the research for that serial killer, he quickly realized that it was going to be way too much for one person to kind of tackle alone. And in order for us to tell his story and the stories of his many, many victims, what we're going to do is we're going to put that off for a week. We're going to start episode 1 of that next week. And it's going to be a two-parter. It's going to be number 1 on our series of Lone Star Lunatics.
That's right.
And we're both going to be actually tackling it together. So we're both going to be kind of presenting different parts of this story. It's going to be horrific, and it's going to be, I think, a really interesting piece, because this is a serial killer who I haven't heard a lot about. I haven't heard a single podcast cover this guy, and he's an absolute sadist and a crazy person, and who probably has victims that really rival in number the Green River Killer.
That's correct.
So we have a very prolific serial killer right here in Texas that a lot of people don't know about. So anyways, that's going to be next week. That's going to be the first part. So we hope you tune into that. And we hope that you like this episode instead.
I think so. And I think it's a good episode. You put me onto this and I started researching it, and I actually really got into it and went down kind of a rabbit hole, which you can do on murderpedia.com and some of the other places that have a lot of information about murder. So let's just get right into it. You want to?
Absolutely.
All right. So Houston is the most populous city in the state of Texas, and it's the fourth most populated city in the United States. And
it's really that much bigger than Dallas?
Yeah. And so in the 2016 census, they had 2.3 million people. Obviously, it wasn't that many back in the time of our crime in 1980, but it hasn't changed that much. And it's also right near the Gulf of Mexico and southeastern Texas, so it's right on the coast. It's known for having the bay, and it was founded on the banks of the Buffalo Bayou.
Known for being very humid. I've only been to Houston like once myself. I went down for a Nine Inch Nails concert.
Nice. Like
a long time ago.
Did you do a bunch of Houston research while you were there?
Not at all.
Well, I'm filling in that gap for you. So it was founded after, obviously, General Sam Houston. And he was the president of the Republic of Texas. So there you go.
Cool.
Yep. All right. So that's where it's taken place. And I also pulled a lot of resources from Murderpedia for the specific case files, as well as I looked at a really interesting documentary from our favorite Women of Death Row. And so I'll be pulling some details about one of our criminals, Pamela Perillo, from that documentary. So we need to really focus on three people to start out with, and it's Linda Fletcher, Mike Brittle, and Pamela Perillo. And on February...
Mike Brittle, as in peanut brittle?
Yes, just like we had on Delicious. The holidays recently. Yeah.
So he's sweet and tasty, is what you're telling me.
No, not at all. Oh. He's caustic and bitter and not good.
Oh, yeah. Too bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, on February 1980, Linda Fletcher met and married Mike Brittle in California when he was in prison. During this time, they also met, once he got out on parole, a 24-year-old Pamela Perillo through a mutual friend. Now, Pamela had several drug addictions. She had some abuse early on in her life. She's 24 years old. She's working as an exotic dancer and was a career criminal. She had already had several robberies under her belt at this point. And Mike and Linda also had similar drug habits, including heroin and some other really heavy designer drugs. And this is going to have a lot to do with some of the explanation to their background and their habits later on in the case. Later that year, Pamela and Mike and another man actually rob a gentleman who was a customer at the Topless Bar where Perillo worked in California. Mike and his wife Linda flee to California on February 14th, 1980 in order to avoid apprehension for the robbery. A few days later, Perillo learns that there's a warrant out for her arrest and joins the couple in Tucson, Arizona.
So Pamela Perillo just, she knew them from her work and everything, and probably they did drugs together, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Mike and Linda run off.
Yep.
To flee robbery charges, and Pamela just decides to go with them?
Well, once she hears that there's a warrant out for their arrest, because she's there when that robbery happens.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she actually helped Mike and another man rob someone who was at her strip club.
Oh, okay.
And Linda really isn't involved at that point. She's just married to Mike, and Mike and Linda decide to flee. Perillo finds out there's a warrant, and she joins up with them in Tucson, and that's when they start hitchhiking their way towards Texas. So on the evening, they're getting various rides from truck drivers and eventually end up in Houston. And on the evening of Friday, February 21st, 1980, the three of them are hitchhiking near the Houston Astrodome. And Bob Banks...
No Texans.
Oh, man. No thanks.
Oh, the poor Texans.
No thanks.
Haven't they lost like the last six games? I think I saw that today. Oh, man,
they're so bad. They're historically bad. And we're Cowboys fans. I know that's going to get a lot of hate, but... You know, we're in Texas.
I had Matt Schaub as my fantasy quarterback for several years. He wasn't that great.
Yeah, he got a lot of hate, too.
Yeah. So, sorry, Texans fans.
Anyways, we're right near the Houston Astrodome. Bob Banks, a 30-year-old oil company worker who was in the process of moving to Houston, stops and offers the three a ride. And there's a picture of the three that you can check out on your notes.
Okay, I'm looking like that. Oh, why is Linda so swollen?
Yeah.
Did she get stung by bees before this? Is she having an anaphylactic reaction?
It's also not a very good picture of all three of them together, but it's one of the very few that I could find, especially with Linda. There's very few pictures of Linda.
Mike Brittle has a little button nose. Okay.
Yeah, he does. And
they look like strung out junkies. I'm just going to say that.
Which is pretty much what they are. I don't know if we mentioned this, but we're drinking really crappy beer and we ate some really low bar tacos because nothing is open on New Year's Day. And I feel like we're slumming it up like this swill that we're covering on the podcast.
Oh, they absolutely drank Rolling Rock and had Taco Casa for dinner. There's no doubt.
Spoiler alert. That's what we had. So back to the Astrodome where Bob is driving around and he sees the three of these people hitchhiking on the side of the road. He pulls over and he asks them if they need a ride. And while they're in the cab, he's chit-chatting with them and he mentions, hey, I just moved to Houston. I'm moving into my new place. Could you guys give me help moving in? They go, yeah, sure. And he's like, I'll compensate you for helping me move. And so they agree to that, and they go and move some of his belongings into his new rent home. Banks then takes them out to eat at a local restaurant. However, when Bob Banks goes to pay for the meal, Linda and Pamela see that he has several hundred dollars in his wallet, and they inform Mike of this.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, that night, when they go back to Bob Banks's place, Mike and Pamela and Linda end up staying the night. And the next day, they help him move some more of his belongings. Now, during this process, Mike sees that Bob Banks has a bunch of guns. And so the wheels start turning in Mike's head as to a possible robbery of this guy.
Yeah, not only do they see him flashing this cash around, but then they see that he has stuff that they want to take.
Yeah, definitely. And... something that can help them out and get down the road, I guess. Yeah.
Well, it was such a nice story up until this point. This guy, like, seeing these three people out, you know, down on their luck, hitchhiking a ride, offers to help them, feed them, give them a place to stay for a few nights. And then I'm assuming something bad is about to happen to this poor guy.
It's also weird, too, because they're on the run from another robbery.
Yeah.
So you think that they would want to lay low and just help this guy out, get a place to stay, maybe get some cash and move along their way.
Yeah.
Not commit more crimes.
That's what a sane person would say, but...
But maybe it was the Rolling Rock and crappy tacos talking.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Maybe it's the anaphylactic shock that Linda is having. I don't
know. The bee stings are getting to her brain.
Yeah, so Mike's starting to think about this possible robbery. Bob Banks goes to take a shower, and that's when Mike decides he's going to call a friend in California. Now, he tells his friend in California, hey, I got a pigeon in Houston. I don't know what that means, a pigeon, but he's referring to Bob Banks as a pigeon. I got a pigeon in Houston with a lot of money and some guns. And the friend declines to help Mike in this potential robbery opportunity. And so that night, after Bob Banks gets done with his showering and gets all dressed up, he's like, hey, we should go to a rodeo at the Astrodome. And of course, they're all like, sure, why not? What's more Texan than a rodeo, by the way? So they're all hanging out.
So this nice guy is, I'm sure, paying their way in to go see this rodeo, yeah. Which probably at the Astrodome probably was a pretty penny just to get in, to get tickets.
And he's paying for everything with $100 bills, straight up.
Oh, this poor guy.
Yeah, and of course they go, and when they're at the Astrodome, Pamela told Mike that she wanted to kill Bob. And he just says, okay.
Kill him. Just straight up. Not just rob him, but just kill him.
Yeah, and Mike's a lunatic. We're going to get into Mike some more later, but he's a straight up lunatic. And he's just like, sure, let's do it. And Mike, wow. But Mike wants to do a little bit of planning first. And he told Pamela to relax, chill your jets. But of course she can't. She's restless. She's a drug addict. And she tells him, no, we're going to do it tonight. And Pamela said that she would like to kill him because he's been touching her. This goes into Pamela's story later on, where she accuses Bob of giving her long looks, making advances at her. Nobody else says this about this time period, but that's kind of her weak excuse for the way things go down. So Bob again invites the group out to a restaurant after the rodeo, and of course he pays for their meal. And when they return home, they find Bob Skeens waiting, which is Bob Banks's friend. The two Bobs. Yes, there's two Bobs in this case. Skeens and Banks. So Skeens is waiting there at the house. He's 26-year-old friend who's come all the way from Louisiana in his green Volkswagen to help Bob Banks move. Good friend, right? Aww. Nice guy. He's a big guy. He's built. He's tough.
My God, most people can't, you know, get their next door neighbor or their best friend who lives down the street to help you move. This guy comes from Louisiana?
Yeah, yep, all the way from Louisiana.
What a nice guy.
Yeah. So the next morning, Banks and Skeens, the two Bobs, go to buy some coffee and donuts for everybody because they're thinking, okay, we're going to do some more moving. We'll get everybody started on the right leg. Well, while the Bobs are gone, Mike arms himself with one of Bob's shotguns. And Pamela does the same thing with one of Banks's handguns that he has around the house. And they split up, and Mike kind of runs off and hides in the closet, and Pamela hides in another room. Linda is just kind of hanging out somewhere in the house. It's not really clear where Linda is at this point. She says she's in another room.
Is she, like, taking a poop? What is she doing during this?
Maybe she's just doing some nice oil paints.
She's knitting.
Yeah.
Okay, Linda, sure. I don't believe you, but okay.
So the Bobs return, and they are kind of looking around trying to figure out where everybody is, and Mike begins tapping inside the closet to get the attention of the men. Right. And so Bob Banks hears this, and he kind of makes his way to the closet, and right before he's about to open the door, Mike explodes out and says, this is a robbery. And at this point, Skeens just drops to the floor and starts begging for mercy. Bob Banks, though, he thinks it's a joke. Like, I've been hanging out with these people for a while. I took them in. I've been helping them out. They seem like nice folks. He approaches Mike with his palms up and his hands out. Mike hits him with the butt of his shotgun.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so hard that he knocks him to the ground and Banks starts bleeding. That's at the point where Pamela emerges from her hiding place in the room next door and tells everyone that it's not a joke. And to listen to what they have to say, that this is a robbery. And now Pamela goes and acquires a machete, and her and Linda go to the garage and
acquires a machete.
Yeah, I guess it was hanging around somewhere. Jeez. At the house. Yeah, she gets a machete, and her and Linda go to the garage and find some rope, and they cut it up into sections so that they can tie up the two Bobs. Mike pulls out Bob's wallet and finds $800 inside, and he's all excited, like he actually did have a bunch of $100 bills in here. Awesome. He starts ransacking the room. He's taking clothes out, filling up a backpack. Pamela finds a cassette recorder and a camera. This cassette recorder, she starts recording on. She just decides to start recording.
She starts recording this robbery.
Yeah. So everything's now on this tape.
Yeah. Real smart group of people right here we're working with.
So remember this tape later on. It'll come back. So Mike takes Skeens into the next room over, and he tells Skeens that he's killed people before, and he doesn't mind killing two more people. He just got out of prison. You know, one of those old things of like, I've been to prison before. I don't mind going back, I guess.
Do we have any corroboration that he had, in fact, killed people, or is he just talking?
He's done a lot of harm in his earlier life. We'll get into some of that later on. Okay. Skeens is staying in this room, and he's kind of listening on what's going on in the next room over. Meanwhile, Mike starts wrapping rope around Bob Banks's neck. Linda says that she witnessed this, but at this point, Linda claims that she leaves and goes outside and just stays in the car.
Sure, Linda.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
I'm already very dubious of this Linda. Okay.
Yeah. And so the claim is that Pamela and Mike both get one end of each of the rope that's wrapped around his neck, and they both pull and strangle Bob Banks.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And, you know, strangulation takes a while.
Yeah.
So they're in there strangling poor Bob Banks. And
wait, all the while is this cassette tape recording?
Oh, yeah.
This. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And Skeens is in the other room and he can hear what's going on.
So he's tied up in the next room.
Right.
Listening to his best friend get murdered.
Exactly.
Jeez.
So after they're done strangling Banks, they take a break and they have some coffee and donuts, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, they're going to relax, you know, take a break. Yeah.
And you know, strangling's hard work.
It is. And you need your Dunkin' Donuts to get you started and fueled up for your next strangling, right?
My God. These people are complete psychopaths.
Oh, they are. Definitely.
Oh, my God.
After they're done eating their coffee and the donuts, they go in and they strangle Skeens in the same manner as they did with Banks.
Wow.
Yeah. And about 20 minutes later, Pamela comes to the Volkswagen with a shotgun wrapped in a blanket, with the machete, the handgun, some other items. Mike brings out his backpack that he has with some stuff and a rifle. They all pile into Skeens' Volkswagen, and they start heading towards Dallas. Now, their plan is to abandon Skeens' Volkswagen once they get to Dallas and catch a bus and ride it to Denver. I don't know what their plan is to go to Denver, but that's the promised land to them, I guess.
Probably go murder some people up there.
Yeah, it's like a Bonnie and Clyde threesome going on, you know?
Bonnie and Clyde and Bonnie.
That's right, Bonnie and Clyde and Bonnie.
God, what a bunch of psychopaths, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is really weird. So on the bus, when they get on this bus headed to Denver, and Linda wakes after she goes to sleep for a little while, she awakes overhearing Pamela playing a tape recording that is the one made on Banks's cassette recorder, and she starts hearing somebody gagging on the recording. And then Linda hears Pamela's voice on the tape say, I don't like looking at your face. Your face is turning blue. Now, Mike and Pamela are kind of amused by this recording.
They're sitting there listening to the mm-hmm. murder somebody laughing. Yeah. On a public bus.
Yeah, that's the other thing. On a public bus.
This is why nobody should take a public bus.
Yeah. Now, again, these are Linda's statements after the fact. So,
yeah,
I mean, I'm not sure how much we can take that, how much salt we want to throw into her statements, you know, if it's a grain or a whole bag, I'm not sure. But anyway, that's Linda's story. Mike eventually sees that Linda is getting upset and makes Pamela turn it off. Huh. So they find their way to Denver. Meanwhile, back in Houston, the Houston police are starting to get wind of this because Banks didn't show up to work for 2 days. And so his supervisor goes over to his house looking for him, and he takes somebody with him. They start peeking through windows, like seeing what they can see. They see a body inside. So they call the Houston police. They come in, they find a crime scene. Then the Dallas police recover the vehicle. They also find, you know, the things that are left in the Volkswagen. There's a machete in there. There's a contact lens case that eventually has Mike's fingerprints on it. And so things are starting to come together with the crime scene. So when the Houston police are at the scene where the bodies of Banks and Skeens are, each of them were bound with rope around their neck. and the chief medical examiner determined that each of them obviously died from asphyxia due to strangulation with the rope. There are some crime scene photos, but I don't think we need to look at them.
No.
They're pretty graphic. Ugh. Yeah. And you'll, if you do look at them, because they were in this article that I read, their hands are bound, their feet are bound, and there's rope wrapped around their neck, and it's pulled, the rope is pulled so tight that there's blood all over their neck.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's awful.
Yeah. So
poor guys, man.
Let's jump back to Denver now, where this murder trio is, and we'll actually see what leads to their apprehension. So they decide to start pawning things that they stole from Bob Banks's house. They pawn the radio cassette player, and they leave the tape in the radio cassette player.
Oh my God.
Freaking idiots, right? They also sell some of the guns to just bar patrons at bars that they're going to. So they're just doing like back alley bar deals for guns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guns with serial numbers, I'm sure, that can be traced back to Bob Banks.
Oh, yeah.
Who is now a murder victim, and they're looking for suspects. And yeah. I'm sure at this point, I probably know that there are guns missing from the house as well.
And they've got like 5 guns from Bob's
These
house.
These guys are brilliant.
Yeah. And like two
this
of
This is what meth does to your brain. This is why nobody should do drugs like
yep,
this.
Yep.
God.
Two of the guns are never found. Like, we still have never found them. They just disappear. But they did recover 3 of them. They recovered the camera that Pamela stole. They found that in the hotel room where everybody was hanging out later. And they found the radio cassette and the radio cassette player.
Now, was the camera, was this a like a video camera or a, you know, a photography camera?
A photography camera, yeah.
Did they take pictures
no.
of the crime? Oh, okay, so they just recorded it on the cassette player.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, so at this point in the journey, Pamela has been trying to get her money. You know, she wants her cut. And she starts to get upset with Mike over money and being on the run. She also has a 2-year-old child back in California. She's trying to figure out, like, where is this all going? Like, you know, are we clear of the original robbery warrants and, like, what's going on back there? Can we start heading back to California? She's kind of losing it. I mean, crazy things have happened. They're now on the run into Denver. Mike gets upset with her. He starts being verbally and physically abusive to her, telling her if she says anything, he's going to kill her. You know, she starts getting afraid, getting scared. She actually tries to go and call the police at a payphone. Mike catches her, threatens her. She ends up just running away out of the hotel.
So what was her intention of accusing?
Well, we're going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
So she just takes off and she finds a random police car just driving around and she stops it and immediately starts confessing to these murders. Later on, the way she puts it is, I wanted to stop running. I wanted to get back to my son. I felt like we were in danger and I feared for myself and I was scared of Mike.
Okay.
But she gives those police in Denver a 26-page confession. 26 pages. And wow. It's like, according to the police officers, like it was the most brutal, detailed confession that they had ever heard.
Now, in this confession, does she admit that she was the one to think of the plan to kill Bob Banks?
Oh, yeah. And her version is also okay. that
well, she's not a very good liar, is she?
Right. And well, in her version, it's that Bob was having advances on her.
Oh, true.
He was oogling over her. He was touching her inappropriately.
Yeah. Okay.
You know. And that's still not a reason to murder somebody.
No.
It's horrible if Bob was actually doing that, but you still don't do what they did. You just maybe get paid and leave.
Yeah.
You know, take your steak dinner and your rodeo and get on down the road. After Pamela gives her confession to the Denver police, she gives them a description of Mike and Linda and tells them where they're staying at the hotel. So the Denver police show up. And for whatever reason, they find Mike and his wife, Linda, inside with 2 boys. I've researched this. I cannot find who these 2 boys are or why they're in the hotel with them, but they never show up again.
Like little boys? Or
it doesn't really say. Everywhere that it's mentioned, it's just with 2 boys. So I don't know what they mean by
That's
2 boys.
Weird.
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have brought it up.
It's
but
it's not their children that they have.
No.
That's okay.
Yeah. 2 people who have not been in the story at all. And it's just, it's barely mentioned. And then they move on.
Huh.
Yeah. I thought that was weird. A Houston detective is alerted to the case and he ends up going to Denver and taking an oral confession from Mike. And Mike confesses to taking the $800 from Banks's wallet and to pulling on one side of the rope along with Pamela to kill Banks. Mike leaves Linda out of the crime, and Mike claims that Linda went to the Volkswagen and was not present in the house for the murders.
So he's saying he and Pamela killed both men.
Yes.
By, you know, each grabbing a length of the rope and pulling it.
Yes. Okay. And tightening the winds that are going around their neck. Now, Mike also notes that it takes probably about 12 to 13 minutes each to strangle them.
Oh my God. Can you imagine? 12 minutes.
Yeah. Because what they estimate it takes like 5 to 7 minutes with your hands to strangle somebody. And they're saying that it took 12 to 13 minutes. So
yeah, because it's going to be equal pressure all around the neck instead of when you do manual strangulation, where it's just in that one particular area that's going to cut off, not only cut off air, but also cut off the carotid artery, which is bringing oxygen-rich blood to the brain, which is, that's actually how a lot of people end up dying or passing out, is because it's not the lack of oxygen, it's the lack of blood that's getting to the brain.
Yeah, and the assistant district attorney, Joe Bailey, has a theory about that, of why it took so long, uh-huh. And it's because it was a nylon rope instead of like a twine rope that's much more taut. It doesn't have as much give to it. Since it was nylon, it was stretchy.
Oh, how awful.
Yeah.
I mean, and think about these poor men being strangled. They're completely tied up. They can't fight back, yeah. Being strangled and taking that long. That is absolutely awful.
Yeah. And when Joe Bailey was asked about the rope, he remembered it as saying during the trial, he got down to the evidence table and he remembered having to open the grocery bag that contained the nylon rope and look at it and show it. And it had caked blood all over it that was chipping off like onto his hands. And he's sweating like during the presentation of this rope. And I don't know. It's very graphic. I don't know. Well, in regards to the cassette recorder that was sold to the pawn shop back in Denver, that pawnbroker listened to the recording on the tape, and as soon as he listened to that tape, he turns the tape over to Denver police. And so that becomes part of the evidence that is used to get convictions for both Pamela and Mike.
Oh, God. Does the jury have to listen to these audio tapes?
You know, I didn't see anywhere that said that, and I went through a lot of the case documents and through the proceedings. I think they were just placed into evidence and had...
Or maybe there was... What's it called? The transcripts of the
yeah.
audio, but mm-hmm. they didn't actually have to listen to
yeah,
the audio.
I think that might have been the case.
I hope so. Because, my God, can you imagine listening to something like that?
Ugh. Yeah. So they're all apprehended, and the cases are being built up at this point. They all get charged, and we get to the different legal cases for everybody. And I'm going to start with Linda first. Linda is...
Oh, little miss. Oh, I was in the yeah. car and I had no idea.
Yeah, she had okay. no idea. She didn't have any coffee or donuts. She just sat in the Volkswagen. You know, she mentions the last time she saw Bob was when he dropped them off on the interstate. Like, she's lying through her teeth. She's wow. also got blood on her jeans when she's apprehended from the crime.
Huh.
So that's something that puts her in the room. But regardless of those things, she's found guilty of robbery, placed on 5 years of probation because she testifies against Mike and Pamela. Yeah.
I hate when that happens.
I know. And Linda gets off so scot-free in this. She doesn't ever have to serve time. She's just on probation.
She's just on probation.
Yeah. Yeah. She never did any time in prison. And it gets more interesting. So Linda's direct testimony was the most damning information to Pamela. Not only as it pertained to the question of Pamela's guilt, but also as it relates to special punishment issues, particularly future dangerousness, which we know in Texas is what can lead to the death penalty.
Uh-huh.
Linda describes Pamela's attitude before the crimes, when the planning is going on, and then after the crimes have been committed on the bus and in Denver, as cold and calculated. She describes Pamela as a cold-blooded killer. So let's get to Pamela. Pamela's interesting. Pamela Perillo, we're not really sure on how to pronounce it. If she's from California, so it might be Perillo.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, she's convicted on killing Bob Skeens. This is basically from the cassette tape where she's talking about his blue face and she doesn't like looking at his face and you hear him die. Yeah. Well, she's originally sentenced to death. And Pamela's attorney tried to use her confession and Linda Fletcher's testimony to portray Mike as like another Charles Manson type character who's pernicious, this is his quote, his pernicious influence led both Linda and Pamela astray down a dark trail of depravity. So he's
these poor, weak women had no part in this. Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Well, Pamela was actually tried twice for murder because of a jury error during her first trial. It doesn't matter because both juries end up sentencing her to death. But in 1988, Pamela files several points of error in her case. 1988, 8 years after the crime is committed, Pamela files several points of error in her case through the appeals court. Specifically, and this is where it gets interesting about her appeals, she contends that her attorney, James Skelton, was hampered in his ability to cross-examine Linda at Pamela's trial because he had represented Linda in her own aggravated robbery trial. Which is a very...
Oh, is that true?
Yes, and it's a very good point.
You can't do that,
buddy. No, you can't. And Skelton admits this, and he says not only was he appointed to represent Linda at her own trial, but he had since become her personal friend and even flown out to California to attend her wedding when she remarried after her marriage to Mike was annulled.
What?
Yes. How crazy is that?
All right. Well,
and
I normally am not very,
sympathetic?
Looking for? Sympathetic to a murderer, but yeah. That's a pretty
Pamela's got a
straight accusation. I get that.
Yeah. And this is why you do the deep digs into the actual case proceedings. and when you go on Murderpedia and you find somebody's case, you go through the appeals because interesting stuff happens in the appeals process.
So insane.
Yeah.
Either way, she still gets sentenced to death.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. She gets thrown on death row. But in 1998, Pamela's been fighting this the whole time she's been in prison. And she actually gets close twice to actually being executed. But in 1998, Pamela files a federal habeas corpus petition stating that her attorney had been disbarred for lying to a client and that she did not receive proper representation during her second murder trial. And as a result, the Fifth Circuit Court of Criminal Appeals rules in Pamela's favor and that she has to be retried or released. So the state of Texas decides they don't want to try this 18-year-old case. That they're just going to settle for a plea and they offer Pamela a one life sentence with 30 years added on for aggravated robbery and murder with the possibility of parole.
Wow.
So okay. Pamela could get paroled. Now, at this point, she's 62. She's serving out her sentence at Texas Women's Correction Center in Gatesville, Texas. And it's just a little bit west of Waco. She's written a book about her life before and after death row. Do you want to know the name of the book?
What?
It's called Salvation on Death Row. It's $4.
Fuck yourself, Pamela. What are you talking about?
Yeah, what was great about it is like when you find those books, they give you the random sample of sections of the book for free. Well, it just happened to be that the random sections that they provided had really great information that I was able to snatch out of there without giving Pamela one red cent of my money.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So Pamela didn't get anything from this. So...
I have a question. You know, the Senna San laws that were passed after Berkowitz.
Yeah.
After Berkowitz, you know, he was trying to get money when he was in prison. He was trying to make money on interviews and his story going out there. And there were laws that were later passed saying that prisoners cannot make money off of their crimes.
Right.
So even if you did buy it, she still wouldn't see that money, right? Or is that like a state law, like a New York state law and not in, I thought it was a federal law.
That's a really great question. I don't know. People need to, if you know federal law and the Son of Sam laws, hit us up in the comments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, because I think the money automatically goes to the victim's family. But I don't know.
Hope.
I would hope so. If anybody wants to buy this piece of garbage.
Well, when she was writing the Salvation on Death Row, the Pamela Perillo story.
Barf.
She tried to contact the victims of the family, or the family of the victims, let's say.
What?
It that way. Yeah. Which is totally illegal. Like, you can't do that. And so, luckily, she was stopped, and they weren't bothered. But she was actively at one point trying to contact them. Which
for
is,
why?
Just to talk to
them. For interviews in her stupid book?
Well, she claims that she was trying to get some kind of... You know, tell them she was sorry and how awful it was.
Oh, I'm sure they want to hear that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Pamela, you sociopath.
So in her book, She claims that her brutal acts were committed due to the heavy influence of designer narcotics and her childhood abuse and molestation.
Okay, you know what? There are a lot of people who are abused and heavy drug users who don't go and murder some guy who was trying to help them out.
Yep.
Just saying.
Yeah. Pamela. But it is interesting, though. I mean, there were some sections of her book where she goes into kind of what these three were doing back then, and it sounds insane. Like, dropping angel's dust, PCP, heroin, cocaine, drinking, and just burgling people.
Ugh,
yeah.
Gross.
Oh, also, fun fact about Pamela. She had a crazy best friend in jail. It was none other than the infamous Texas killer, Carla Faye Tucker.
What?
Yes. So Carla Faye Tucker is her best friend in prison. And when Carla Faye Tucker got lethally injected, it ruined Pamela. Like, she was...
Oh, my God.
She, quote...
No, that's actually a book I would like to read. It's the Jail Time Adventures of Carla Faye Tucker and Pamela What's-Your-Nuts.
I know.
Holy crap.
Yeah, and if you don't know anything about Carla Faye Tucker, she...
We might... Well, that's not... We might cover her.
Okay.
I would imagine that would be a good one.
We might cover... I'll just say that there's a pickaxe involved and a lot of murder.
Yeah.
And she got off on it. That's all I'll say. All right. So are you ready to get into Mike? We'll wrap this up with what happened to Mike afterwards.
Yeah. Tell me something bad happened to him.
Okay. So pull up your notes again and you get your photo of Mike with his stupid teardrop tattoo under his left eye.
Ugh. What a nasty looking man. Yeah. That's a dude I would, if I saw him on the street, I'd be like, that dude's a murderer.
Mm-hmm. His stupid soul patch. Well, Mike ends up being convicted of killing Robert Banks. And early in the appeals process...
Wait, so Pamela was convicted of murdering the other...
Skeens.
Okay.
From Louisiana.
Okay.
Yes, because of the cassette tape. And Mike was tried and convicted for the killing of Bob Banks, the oil worker.
Mm-hmm.
Early in the appeals process, Mike was represented by an Ohio attorney, Alton Stevens. And Stevens said of Mike... that he had a glare like Charles Manson. I don't know why everybody keeps referring to him as Charles Manson, but I guess he had this like creepy vibe to him where he just had dead eyes or something and was a lunatic.
Weird.
But when he...
And had two female followers. I guess maybe that's where it comes from.
Yeah, maybe. Probably. You're probably right. I didn't think about that. But when he would enter the courtroom, everybody was told to back up against the walls. All the persons, except for Stevens and several other deputies, were ordered to stay 15 feet away from Mike at all times during the trial.
What?
Yeah, and apparently it had to do with, like, his history, and he was known as a violent criminal. He was a very violent guy, and let me get in a little more information about Mike. Stevens said, "I never saw Mike when he wasn't either in shackles or in a cage. I was sure he was sedated with Thorazine or Prolixin every time that I visited him. But I was impressed about how articulate he was, even though he was highly doped." So this kind of goes back to his psychoanalysis that was done when he was in San Quentin in California.
So he was also imprisoned in San Quentin, where Charles Manson was imprisoned.
Yes. Well, he had signs of borderline personality disorder, as well as brain dysfunction that was due to a possible injury. And it should be noted here that Mike's mom was in an automobile accident when she was pregnant, and that it caused complications with Mike. Like, he was born 4 to 6 weeks late. And the doctors in this part say something I've never heard before. They say the birth, quote, required extensive use of forceps to deliver him and possibly caused cranial damage and deformation. And so that's attributed by his psychoanalysts and his medical history and other doctors as maybe there's a brain damage or like some kind of brain malformity in Mike. He also has, what's it called? The borderline personality disorder.
Was this his defense?
Yes.
Psychologist. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, I don't believe you.
No, I don't either.
Again, not an excuse. You can have BPD and you can have...
Yeah.
You can have been birthed through forceps and not go around murdering people. So
I just thought that description of requiring extensive use of forceps to deliver him to possibly cause cranial damage and deformation. I had never heard anything like that. I thought that was funny.
That sounds quite ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, Mike, he didn't have an easy life. His early years, he mostly was spent locked up in juvenile detention. He was an angry child. He was a bully. He got an assault charge when he was 17 because he shoved another youth under a train.
Jesus!
Yeah, And the victim lost both arms and a leg.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so Mike was previously serving time in California.
Why was he ever released after that? Are you kidding me?
This dude has basically just lived in prison his entire life.
And okay, that's another parallel, actually, to Charles Manson. So maybe there are a few, you know, similarities between these two.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, he met Linda while he was in prison, like I said earlier. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he got paroled, they got married.
How romantic.
I know, right? I don't know if there were... I don't even want to know about the conjugal visit situation. Why is that a thing?
I don't know.
Why do we have to let people get conjugal visits?
We don't have to, I don't think.
Can we start a motion to stop conjugal visits? I want one. Not a conjugal visit. No. I want a law to stop them. I don't want one.
I want a conjugal visit.
All right.
Creep.
But yeah, so back when he's in California and he's serving time there for theft and forgery, that's apparently when Mike joined the Aryan Brotherhood.
Oh, great.
Now, we've gone down this long rabbit hole of Mike's background for a reason. I'm going to bring you all back to current times. It's because of these reasons that Mike ends up receiving the death penalty. The prosecution brings all this stuff up at his trial. They go through all of it, and this is a lot of the basis why his special punishment question, you know, when they ask the jury, is there a probability the defendant would commit acts of violence that would constitute a continuing threat to society? They have to ask that, and that's how we determine if they're going to get the death penalty in Texas. Well, you have to fill out a form, and all it took was one juror to say no. Every single juror filled out the form with, oh, yes, exclamation. So, yes, there is a reason he's going to commit further acts of violence and, you know, constitutes a threat to society. Yeah,
everybody's sure of that fact.
Yeah. So Mike gets several standard appeals, you know, but to no avail. He tries to pull some stuff over in his appeals process, but none of it sticks. And in 1984, while serving out his sentence and waiting on death row for the 1980 slayings of the two Bobs, Mike and another condemned killer on death row are implicated in a death row firebombing, and they try and kill a black inmate who they don't kill him, but he's severely injured in his cell.
Oh my God.
Like, I'm telling you, dude, he's just a straight up,
Mike,
like,
just get him out of here.
You can't murder him fast enough. You can't get rid of Mike fast enough.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say.
He
has no
here.
Place in this world. He's doing no good to us.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, anyways, here's the best part. I mean, I guess the final part, the closing chapter, is that on December 12th, 1995, in Huntsville, Texas, James Michael Brittle, age 40, was strapped to a death chamber gurney about an hour after the United States Supreme Court rejected his final appeal. He told his two brothers, which were standing in the death chamber with him, that he loved them and he would see them in heaven or wherever else. They started the flow of the lethal injection solution. His flow and his blood circulation was too slow in his left arm. And, you know, he had a tough life. Well, he also had a tough death, because they end up moving the needle around three different times. And what's supposed to be a really quick lethal injection, you know, it ends up being like half an hour for them to actually get it right. And they move it from his, you know, his main vein to his hand to his forearm, taking like 8 to 12 minutes in between each one. And then finally, after half an hour, James Michael Brittle was pronounced dead. He was the 104th Texas inmate to be put to death by lethal injection.
Oh, wow. I can't say that I'm necessarily sad about it, but, you know, a lot of people have a problem with the death penalty. I'm not necessarily a supporter of it, but
I've seen both ways.
I'm also not sad that he's not around anymore. So, you know, there's that.
Well, you know, he wasn't doing any good in prison. He was firebombing black inmates because he was an Aryan Brotherhood member.
What a monster.
So what do you think about that? Was that good? Did you enjoy it? Was it interesting?
I definitely enjoyed it. I mean, my God, these three clearly psychopaths. I can't believe that Linda just got off scot-free.
Oh, and do you want to go back and talk
about that? I mean, she didn't even get a sentence for the robbery.
Yeah.
She just got probation, even though she robbed the guy.
Yeah.
And, and if only that, you would think you would get at least a couple years.
Sure. And I didn't talk about this at the time, but there is a lot of confusion and mixed up stories that Pamela points out in her trial.
Uh-huh.
And she gets thrown under the bus by Linda. And Pamela comes straight out and says, you know, Linda was there at one point when they were strangling Bob Banks. Mike stops and he calls Linda into the room and makes her hold the rope and finish the strangling.
Well, do we have that on the cassette tapes?
No.
Hmm.
No. But that's Pamela's story.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, that's what happens. I mean, the first person to come forward and make a plea bargain with the prosecution team, they're going to get the best results.
Yeah.
And it sucks, but it's also, I mean, based on her words, that's how we were able to get. Well, I guess we didn't even need her words. I mean, we had the testimony of the recording that they made themselves.
Yeah.
How awful. Those poor guys, I can't believe. It's such a horror story to think of inviting somebody into your home and trying to, you know, give them a leg up, give them some money, have them, you know, have them do a job for you. You're going to pay for their food and everything. Give them a place to stay for a few days. And then they just murder you.
Yeah.
To take your $800 and a few guns.
Yeah. And to bring us back to the beginning, this was the benefit of Bob's kindness.
Ugh. Poor Bob.
I know. He seemed like such a nice dude. I guess we can move on from this, or unless you have anything else to say.
No, that was depressing. I'm ready for...
ready for good news?
I'm ready for some good news.
Okay, what do you got for us, Aaron? Slap us with your good news.
I've got a good story coming from... This is, again, a story coming from Hurricane Harvey victims. Obviously, we know that there's still a lot of restoration going on. There's still a lot of people who need a lot of help. And so this is yet another story of somebody getting a little bit of help for something that they need. So this is Eric Harding and his family. They're a family of, I believe, 7 or 8. So they have a huge family. He is from... Friendswood, which is a town about 20 miles south of Houston, and a huge amount of homes were destroyed by flood water. Mm-hmm. And about 5 days after the flooding hit, Eric went back to his house and he just saw the absolute devastation of his home. In the living room was set up a piano. He was a piano player himself. His father restored pianos for a living, and one of his children, his 14-year-old son Ryler, was also a musician and used this piano a lot. So this is this music has a really important part of this family's life, and this piano is sitting in like 4 feet of flood water.
Oh no.
So Eric goes up to the piano and he starts playing, and he shared this moment on Instagram and he captioned it, "I think it's all finally sinking in a little. What we used to have going as a city is gone. I really think God is going to do something completely new here. I'm excited to see the new beauty and the suffering," which is kind of a nice, thing to say. That's about such a horrible thing. But, it's just really sad to be watching somebody playing a piano in the devastated, flooded living room where their, entire family used to be.
Is that the good news?
No.
Oh, okay.
What are you talking about? That's not the good news.
That sounds sad.
The good news is that this very, this sad but almost uplifting kind of story gets shared. It goes around social media and Vanessa Carlton sees it. So that's the girl who she's the pop singer with the piano. That girl?
Wait, explain, where is she from? Like The Voice or like some kind of talent show or something?
No. I only know that one song that was popular like 10 years ago.
People.
If I can just see you tonight.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that person.
That person. Anyways, Vanessa Carlton saw this and it really touched her. She thought it was really sad. And she kind of thought about the power of music to really uplift people.
Oh, okay.
So she gets in touch with CNN, who had shared the story, to get Eric's information. She partners with Yamaha and she says that she wants to help him get a new piano donated for his family. They're able to donate. Eric's family was able to actually pick out their own piano that they were to have replaced. So they got a Yamaha with a lock for the lid that covers the keys. Like I said, he has a lot of kids. So this helps protect the piano.
Yeah.
And, Eric said, "Really, my whole life we've been around pianos. It'll mean a lot to have the family piano back. It was such a major piece of the house. I'm hoping that it'll look like a bit of a full circle, a continuation of restoration."
Aww.
And Vanessa Carlton said, I'll never forget the moment I saw that video of Eric playing his piano in a flooded living room. I couldn't go back to my normal day after seeing that image. I'm glad I didn't. I'm blown away by everyone who came to the plate and made this happen for this family. Thank you to Yamaha and CNN and everyone who contributed their time and efforts. The world is a pretty spectacular place sometimes.
Wow.
So this family, they're rebuilding their house and they got a brand new piano to help share their love of music. So it's
that's
a very
a
nice
story.
Thank you, Vanessa Carlton. I'm sorry I don't know more of your music.
I liked your rendition, though. Somebody please like get that little snippet of that song and post it so I can understand what the hell she's talking about. I'm sure she's really talented and a great artist, and she sounds super cool.
It's definitely a nice story.
Okay.
Thank you, Vanessa Carlton.
That was a nice palate cleanser. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and we got to hold up our end of the bargain. We have iTunes reviews, so somebody sent
minus
us...
the S, because it's just a one.
Well, there's something else happening with iTunes right now. We know we've had more than one, but a new one has showed up. We had Michelle's last week, and so Heather sends us a 5-star review, and she says, "I can't wait for more episodes. The first two are excellent." Thank you, Heather. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Heather. We're very happy to see that we have a review. So we really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And if you would like to review us, we would love it. We would prefer you review us on iTunes, but you can review us on whatever platform you're listening to this on. That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
If you have anything to email us, if you have any questions, comments, dumb remarks, please email them to allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And please follow us on our social media, ACNC Podcast on Twitter and on Instagram. We are All Crime No Cattle. We post some behind the scenes stuff, and we also have additional media from each episode to share with you, so you can get a little bit more context for the stories that we talk about.
Yeah, just an example. Aaron posted a picture of our canine crime unit, the doggos. We had them on Christmas Eve cuddling and staying warm. A lot of people like that one. They like the doggos.
And again, this eventually has just become a podcast about our dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they're going to have their own podcast. So what was the name of their podcast that they do when we're not around? They sneak in here. Snuggles and Snacks.
Snuggles and Snacks.
That's what it is. Snuggles and Snacks.
Oh, God.
Oh, it's so ridiculous.
We're such horrible,
yeah, we're
gross
terrible
dog people.
But no, there's a cool post that Aaron put up about the last episode, the lynching of Alan Brooks. She put up some really neat photos of the Elk's Arch. Some extra stuff to go along with that story. So go check that out.
Yeah. Oh, and do we want to do a little bit of a shout out of some of the states that have downloaded our...
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Because some of you were like, I don't understand why you're listening to this, but I'm glad you are.
Yeah, well.
Because we have a lot of, so California, I know, is just off the top of my head. I know that California
is
enjoying
the show.
Well,
first, let's talk about global first.
Oh.
We'll get to you, California. So we have people in Canada listening. We have people in Australia listening. The United Kingdom is leading our outside the United States listens.
Thank you, UK.
Yes, thank you, UK. I'm sorry for Brexit, but.
We should... to celebrate this, we should next time talk in a accent from each of those countries.
Oh no, they're gonna hate us.
That's a total joke because I can't do accents.
You can't. Okay, so in the U.S., California's kicking butt. They've got quite a few views there. I think, yeah, they're the biggest state outside of Texas. Clearly, we're dominating Texas.
Cali. Of course, yeah. I mean, that's obvious.
Yeah, and then California is coming up. After that, and then Illinois and Nebraska holding it down.
Illinois and Nebraska. Yeah. I haven't even been to either one of those states, I don't think. But thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you so much. And we've been getting support from Potter and Family on Twitter.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the hashtag Potter and Family. It's a bunch of podcasts that support each other in like a podcast network. So we're getting a little coverage nationally thanks to that and globally. Do you have anybody else that you want to mention? East Coast is listening. That's just a lot of states. Florida, Indiana, Maryland, New Jersey, Virginia. And then some others. South Carolina showed up today. Oklahoma finally got in the game. You're our neighbor, Oklahoma. What are you doing?
What are you doing? What about Louisiana? They
Louisiana showed up today.
Oh, good.
We got some views in Louisiana.
I also would like to thank Jenny, who is a friend of us, a friend of ours, who sent us a few emails, and she's kind of trying to make some recommendations about some cases that she wants us to cover. So
yeah.
Thank you, Jenny, for that.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to send in case recommendations, hit us up. We're open. And so for next time, we're going to keep working on our first Lone Star Lunatic, our first Texas serial killer. It's going to be good. I think you'll appreciate it when it happens that we spend extra time on it.
I think so, too. All right. Well, we will see you next week for your midweek
hump day hot hour.
All right, guys. See you then.
All right. Adios.
Bye.